Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Author and journalist Fred Waitzkin captivated our hearts and minds years ago with his critically acclaimed and best-selling memoir about his chess prodigy son in searching for Bobby Fischer. Now, 30 years later, he makes his fiction debut with the novel The Dream Merchant, and it is my pleasure to welcome Fred Waitzkin to the program today to talk about The Dream Merchant. Fred, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. At the core of this novel really is the business of being a salesman, of selling, and that was something that was a big part of your father's life and a big part of your growing up and your family. Talk a little about that.
Well, it's true. My dad was a salesman, and growing up in the 50s in the New York area, my dad was selling fluorescent lighting fixtures, but he was a tremendously gifted salesman. He sold lighting for all of the big buildings that were put up around that time. And when I say all of them, I mean literally all of them. He sold the buildings for the lighting for the Seagram building, the Saucony building, Aqueduct Racetrack, the United Nations building. He was a super salesman, and I worshipped him. I loved the ground that he walked on. But my dad crossed a lot of lines to make all those deals. Some salesmen do. It didn't bother me when I was a kid. I loved his chutzpah and his charisma. But, I've been haunted by salesmen my entire life. And in one way or another, they sort of creep into a lot of the things that I write. But I had this idea from early on that I would write a book about a salesman, a super salesman.
Did you have an idea as a kid, or is it clearer to you today? What was the secret of his success? Was it just hustle? Was it drive? Was there something else?
There are a lot of elements, that go into making anyone who's great at something. But like for a salesman and for my dad and also for the central character of The Dream Merchant, he was just a great guy to be around. He was like the best friend you ever had while he was your friend, whether that was for 3 months or 6 months or 2 years or 15 years. That's how my dad was. And so people were drawn to him. And of course, he was just incredibly persuasive. And there's a certain magic in that. I mean, it's sort of like you can't say, well, if you take these four elements and put them in the soup, the cabbage and the carrots, you'll necessarily get a great salesman. He just had it. It's sort of like, why was Michael Jordan the greatest basketball player that ever lived? He just had it. My dad was sort of a born great salesman.
It's interesting because it is so indigenous to the time. We talk about sales today, and I don't know if you're familiar with Daniel Pink's current book about sales being a very different business today, more consultative, less the traditional idea of selling. And yet, your father and Jim, the protagonist in this story, really represent the old school kind of selling.
I think that's true. I think it's true. Although, having said that, about 2 months ago, I walked into a clothes store, and I wanted to buy a pair of pants. And they didn't have the pants that I wanted, but the guy, the salesman that I was dealing with was so charismatic that before I left, I bought a jacket, I bought a tie, and I bought a belt. And I was dumbstruck because I hadn't intended to when I walked into the store. And I was so taken with his selling magic that about a week later, I went into the store and told him, you're really great. I just wanted to tell you that. And he kind of blinked at me because he didn't know where I was coming from. So there's still great salesmen around.
It's so interesting because part of, and this really relates to the large part of the book, once the character goes down to Brazil, and I want you to talk about that,
sure,
is that that salesman is selling himself as much as he is somebody else. It's always reinforcing his own value and his own worth and showing himself what he can do.
You're right. I mean, for a great salesman, the product doesn't matter at all. He is selling himself. And that's what we see in The Dream Merchant. Jim, it doesn't matter what the product is. He can sell it, and he's got the guys ready to buy it because as we said, he's selling himself. That's what people love.
Talk about his decision at a certain point in his life, your character, to shed all of that and leave and go down to Brazil.
Right. Well, in the novel, Jim starts from a situation of acute poverty. He's a kid growing up in Canada, Depression times. And the family's literally starving to death and freezing to death because they live in an unheated home. And the father has abandoned them. He's a ne'er-do-well father. And this kid, who's energetic and smart, figures out a way at 8 years old to save his family. But he's imprinted by the poverty of his youth. And he becomes a salesman. And he really, really wants to become wealthy. And without giving away too much of the book, he'll take every shortcut. He'll do whatever it takes to close the deal, very much like my dad did. And he becomes tremendously wealthy. There's a lot of territory that takes place in the novel that I'm skipping over. But he gets to the top. He makes a fortune in money. He owns a tremendously exotic estate. He owns yachts. He owns a Learjet. And then he loses everything. I mean, literally everything. The house of cards collapses. I won't tell you exactly what happens. Again, I don't want to reveal so much of the plot about the book while I'm describing it. He loses everything, but he's still got that burning core inside, a determination to get back to what he had and more. And so he goes to the Amazon. And let me tell you a little bit about the Amazon. In 1984, which was the year that I wrote Searching for Bobby Fischer, I happened to read a piece in Time magazine about gold mining in the Amazon, and it completely blew my mind. I'd never heard of anything like it except from Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. Basically, in the jungle, in the rainforest, you have these camps called Garimpos, and what they are basically is our lawless little kingdoms. And if you would envision a cleared space in the jungle, let's say about two-thirds the size of a football field, or half the size of a football field. And in this clearing, you would have a cantina, which is basically a restaurant, cooking facilities, a barracks where the owner would live, but also where his gunmen would live, because these camps are overrun by marauders. People are continually coming into these camps, taking them over, slaughtering everybody that's there because they want the gold for themselves. So each camp has its own little army. And it also has a brothel with working girls, and I'll explain why in a second. Now, around the circumference of the camp, you've got miners that are digging into in the earth, let's say 700 or 800 or even 1,000 of them. And it's very hard and it's very dirty. And it's very dangerous work because surrounding the camp are all sorts of wild animals, jaguars that are lured towards the camp by the smell of the food. And some of these guys are murdered in their hammocks at night. But anyway, these little guys are digging in the mud. The idea being that they're going to take the gold dust and if they're really lucky, the gold nuggets that they find, sell them to the owner of the Garimpo, and take the money back to the cities like Manaus and to bring their families out of poverty. But in fact, what happens is that after they've been digging for a month, they have, say, approximately $1,500 worth of money that they've collected, and they hear the sounds of music coming from the camp, and they smell the food, and they wander into the camp, and they see these women, and they're gorgeous, really gorgeous, young and beautiful, and particularly so after digging in the mud for a month. So they spend all of the money that they've earned in this month of dangerous, filthy work on this one night of desire. And then they're completely broke again, and they have to go back into the jungle and dig for another month. And then it happens again. So it's kind of Sisyphusian. It just goes on forever. And the only person that makes any money out of this is the guy that owns the camp. So in 1984, I had this idea that someday I'd like to write a novel about a super salesman who'd go into the jungle. It was the idea of my novel was that Willie Loman would meet Kurtz in the jungle. And it took me 30 years to get to the book, but that was the idea that I had.
There's also a woman that is at the heart of his story in Brazil, a much younger woman.
Well, this character, over the course of his many years, because he lives to be a ripe old age, sheds his skin 3 or 4 times. He becomes a different person. And younger women facilitate these changes. he desires them, of course, as many men desire beautiful young women. But also, they help him regenerate himself. And in the jungle, he meets a beautiful young woman. She's much, much younger than him. And he falls in love with her. And there's a part of the story here that I don't want to reveal because it's very violent, it's very difficult. Terrible things happen relative to this woman. But that's a part of the movement that's consistent with his entire life.
There's also this aspect of people like Jim, people that are super salesmen, terribly charismatic, winding up with younger women. That is a contemporary issue as well.
It's true, and I've observed that. And before I started writing the book, I wanted to explore that element because it's kind of a taboo element in American fiction. I can only think of a couple of good novels, not American novels, that really explore this idea of an older man with a younger woman. But I wasn't really sure if I was on solid ground. So before I started writing the book, I have, of course, a background in journalism. So I talked to a lot of younger women. I did my own little private Kinsey report. I spoke to about 40 or 50 women, friends of my kids, people that I'd meet, waitresses that I'd meet, people that I knew in the office where I had my studio. And I found that nearly half the women that I spoke to had either had a relationship with an older man or would have been up for it if they liked the guy. The other half didn't like the idea at all, and they wouldn't even consider it. But as you say, Jim is like a lot of very powerful men, you know, right off the top, George Soros, Tony Bennett. There are a lot of guys that sort of have a need for younger women in order to. Picasso had young mistresses his entire life. He talked about the fact that the inspiration for his work came from his young lovers.
It's a combination, one of being a muse, and the other of kind of reinforcing their own strength, their own virility, as salespeople. I mean, we see it in politicians all the time.
Right, right. This guy, what is his name? Mark Sanford. And the big scandal. He left his wife for a young South American woman. No, we see it all the time. And Jim is that kind of a person. I mean, he's a powerful man, and he's kind of nurtured in a very fundamental way. The book is narrated in an unusual way. I tell the book the story from the end of the life moving forward to the young life. And we see him at the beginning of the book as a man in his late 70s, and he's down on his luck for like the third time in his life. And he's in Israel trying to recreate himself in business once again. He's doing network marketing, but he really is Willie Loman at this point in his life. I mean, he's down on himself, he's depressed, he's lost his confidence, he has no money. And he's talking to a group of people in a hall in Israel. And amongst them is this a woman that we find out is 26 years old. She's beautiful. And she focuses on him in a way that's jarring to him because he doesn't quite understand why she's admiring him so much. And to make a long story short, they have a relationship. And their relationship is at the core of the book because he tells his story to her as well as to a narrator who's a friend of his. And we explore primarily the nature of this dynamic between the older man and the younger woman through their relationship. Let me just say one more thing about her. Her name is Mara, and she's a very dark person. She's a manipulator. So we kind of have this love affair between two master manipulators.
You mentioned something before about this having been, at least in your research, kind of a taboo subject in fiction. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think maybe because it's a complicated question. I mean, when I first started writing the book, and I showed it to my first agent, because the book has had a number of incarnations. I made changes to it over a number of years. When I first showed it to my agent, who was of somewhat of an advanced age, and she was a woman, she loved the sex in the book because a lot of the sex is explicit. But she said that she thought that women might be put off by it, and that maybe I ought to consider taking it out. And I did do that, but the book wasn't alive to me with the sex out of the book because that was a real element. I mean, to understand Jim, he's a very lusty guy, and you have to see him in that modality to really appreciate the character that I was writing. So I put it back in. And then when I started showing it to women, I thought women really like the physical side of the book. So I think my earlier agent was wrong.
Right. It's interesting about Jim. You talk about him being lusty. It really is a character that is about appetites, his sexual appetite, his appetite for success, for money, for all of the things that it buys.
No, you're right. He's a guy of huge appetites, and he's very inspiring. And I might have used this phrase before, but he's a real character in the sense that if you meet him, you'll love him because he engenders hope. You know, he's the kind of person that on the worst day of your life can make good. And you'll love him for as long as he's with you and you're with him. But then at one point in your life, he'll walk away from you. And it's devastating. You leave a lot of people ruined in his wake.
What did you learn about your own relationship with your father? What did you come to understand as a result of exploring this character?
What I learned was that the kind of fundamental love that you have for a father or an incredibly good friend, it's larger than particular events. Let me try to explain what I mean by that. In this novel, Jim does really, really terrible things. You got to take my word for it. I don't want to give it away, but he does things that they're not small sins. They're really big mortal sins. But yet the narrator, who has a relationship to Jim in the same way as one would have to one's father, loves him in spite of the things that he does. The love kind of is larger than the deed itself. And I think it's true. I mean, if you have a parent, your father can do terrible things and you'll still love him. I think it's just built into the human condition.
What do you want your own son to understand about this relationship, the nature of this kind of relationship?
I think he already understands it. I think that I don't think he needed this novel to understand it. I think that, you know, there's a lot of love between me and my son and me and my daughter, for that matter. But I think that if I can digress for a minute, I had an elderly friend who I won't name, who died a couple of years ago, and he was a writer. He didn't get the recognition that he deserved, but he was a very, very good writer. And I used to meet him for lunch, and he was one of the great storytellers that I'd ever met. One time we were enjoying a lunch together, and at the end of the lunch he said to me, "You know, I want to tell you a story." And I said, "Sure." But his whole manner had changed, and I could tell that it was a different kind of story than he'd ever told me before. I don't know if I have time to tell you the whole story. How much time do we have? It's an amazing story, but you want me to tell it in shorthand?
We have time. Go ahead.
Okay. This is the story that he told me. He said, "One day, when I was 11 years old, I was friends with a guy who was about 13, who was a bully. But I was a very timid kid." This was what my friend was telling me. He was approaching 80 at this point. He said, "I was a timid kid, and my friend was a bully, and I was kind of honored to be friendly with this guy. And one day we were walking near a woods, and the guy pointed to a house, and he said, 'Let's go in this house and mess around with it.' It was a house that wasn't quite built yet. So the two boys went into the house, and the bully started ripping up cement bags and throwing bricks through the windows. And he encouraged my friend, who was a timid guy, to do the same. My friend was a little afraid to do it, but he started doing it in a half-hearted way. And the bully pushed him even harder. And he said, 'Listen.' And he squatted down on the floor, and he relieved himself on the floor. And then he took his excrement and put it against the wall. And my friend was appalled. But the bully forced him to do the same thing. And the two boys went home, and sure enough, the police came to my friend's house. And my friend's father was an army colonel. He was kind of a hero type, very, very charismatic, very respected in the community. The police knocked on the door, and they said, do you know anything about this vandalism that took place in a house?' And the father said, 'Of course not, of course not.' But this kid was mortified, you can imagine. He felt like he was going to die, that his father would find out that he'd done such a terrible thing. So the two kids don't see each other for another month. But then they start hanging out again. And my friend said, at the same time he disliked this guy, it was like a tabooed relationship that he was drawn to. So one day, they're walking past the house again. And this is at the edge of a woods. And this older boy, this bully, says, let's go in the house and do it again. And my friend is thinking about his father and the love and respect that he has for his father. And his rage, he smashes the older boy, who falls onto the ground and hits his head on a rock. The older boy is lying on the ground, and his head is near a stream. And my friend, who's telling me this at 76 years of age, a story that happens 65 years before, takes the kid's head and holds it under the water until the bully stops breathing. He's dead. And then my friend goes home and waits for the police to come. And they never come. They never come. And all of this comes from this feeling that he has about his own dad and the humiliation that he feels for having done this desecration before. This is the rage that he feels, and he actually kills this kid. So he told me this story before he was dying. Of course, it was implicit between the two of us that I would never write it while he was alive. I actually wrote the story in the Huffington Post. It appeared about 3 weeks ago.
Fred Waitzkin, his novel is The Dream Merchant. It's just out from St. Martin's Press. Fred, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I've enjoyed our conversation, Jeff.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.